obliquely. "Sir, the position of the United States is to support peace between Israel and the Palestinians," I said. "The President is working hard to see negotiations resumed." "America could have many friends in the Muslim world," Abdullah said, "but Israel divides us. Unless there is peace, terrorism will spread around the globe." "Your Highness," I said, "terrorism is spreading like a cancer, and we can all work harder to stop it, America and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia." He spread his hands in acceptance, and then smiled. "We ask God for logic and reason, and I am sure we will work side by side to stop the spread of terrorism. Sir, you have my commitment to be your friend and your partner." Breaking protocol, I held out my hand Midland style. Crown Prince Abdullah shook it. "We have heard a lot about you, General." "I hope some of it good," I said. "A lot of it good." He rose. The audience was ending. "We have high expectations." That night on the plane, I thought back about my favorite jobs in the military, commanding a brigade, a division, a field army. Straightforward soldier's work. My world was becoming a lot more complex. Back in Washington, I called on the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Army General Hugh Shelton, who was pleasant and informative. I'd known Hugh since my days in ARCENT, when he had been Commander-in-Chief of United States Special Operations Command. Tall and craggy, with a Carolina twang to his voice, Hugh had served two combat tours in Vietnam, as a Green Beret and as a paratroop company commander, before rising steadily in command responsibility. When I mentioned that my staff had scheduled an afternoon office call with Richard Clark, the counterterrorism specialist on the National Security Council, Hugh frowned. "Tom," he said, "Secretary Cohen prefers that the commanders-in-chief coordinate their contacts with senior civilian officials through his office, and that's especially true with Dick Clark." I listened. Washington at the commander-in-chief level was new territory. "Clark's been over at the NSC so long that he thinks he owns counterterrorism, Tom. He thinks he knows more about the subject than anybody in government," you added. "He likes to talk, he drops lots of names, and he thinks highly of himself. In many ways, he's not very practical. Be careful in dealing with him." I thanked Hugh for the heads up. Clark's secretary had told my staff that he would see me in his White House office, but the Pentagon driver took me over to the old executive office building, a separate facility connected to the West Wing. A small point, I thought, as I climbed the marble stairs to Clark's office. "General Franks," he said, rising from his desk to shake my hand. Then he ducked back to close an orange-bordered, top-secret-sensitive folder on his desk. "Security-conscious," I thought. "That's a good trait for a counterterrorism specialist." Clark spoke quickly and intensely, as if he possessed urgent information that was critical to my mission. With his wiry, close-cropped gray hair, probing dark eyes, and serious manner, he reminded me of an actor cast as a high government official dealing with a grave crisis. The subject was Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Clark began a review of the available intelligence, which was recent, but predictably imprecise. He described the success of the 1998 Tomahawk land attack missile strikes, the TLAMs, into Afghanistan. But he had nothing to say about the strike against the suspected chemical weapons plant in the Sudan. Interesting, I thought. There had been a flap about that strike, with a number of news stories suggesting that it had been based on faulty intelligence and that the Sudan facility had had nothing to do with chemical weapons. I wondered if Clark thought it had also been a success. We then discussed the United Arab Emirates, a federation of seven small, immensely wealthy Gulf oil states that, along with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, had extended diplomatic recognition and financial aid to the Taliban. Clark told me about his personal ties with the royal family in Abu Dhabi. He described a direct connection between the United Arab Emirates and the Taliban, and told me that this conduit had proven very helpful to him in working the bin Laden problem. I listened without commenting. I asked about intelligence reporting on Al-Qaeda. "Dick, for CENTCOM to build realistic operational plans, we need usable intelligence," I told him. "You know, Tomahawk land attack cruise missiles will hit the exact coordinates that are programmed into their guidance systems. but reports about the cave where Osama bin Laden was thought to have slept last week don't produce a target, Dick. Eventually, we may figure out a trend, but in order to strike him, we need real-time information. Clark smiled knowingly and described certain technologies that he thought would help with the problem. I understood at once he was referring to the Predator Unmanned Aerial Vehicle, the UAV, a reconnaissance drone that could loiter over hostile territory for hours, transmitting high-quality real-time video, day or night. The Central Intelligence Agency was working to arm the Predator with a Hellfire missile system. A potentially powerful tool, I thought, even as I reminded myself of an old military adage, it's dangerous to confuse desire with capability. I wondered if Dick Clark had ever heard the expression. I was interested in destroying the Al-Qaeda threat, but my visit with Dick Clark had not moved me any closer to that objective. I left his office hoping that my emphasis on practical solutions to real problems would spur him to home in on some real targeting opportunities. But I suspected that Dick was better at identifying a problem than at finding a workable solution. On January 9, 2001, in the waning days of the Clinton administration, I had another visit with Dick Clark. He called me from the National Security Council to discuss the government's pursuit of bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. This was about 15 months after Al-Qaeda's murderous attack on the USS Cole. Clark talked for a while without advancing any meaningful options. George Tenet had already briefed me on agency activities in Afghanistan and Central Asia. But I listened to Clark patiently, because he said that the incoming Bush administration was going to retain him in his counterterrorism position at the NSC. As we spoke, Clark shared sensitive information regarding the Predator Plus program. He told me that the operation was moving ahead well and might soon reap results. He also said that our human intelligence performance was improving, but he didn't elaborate. "Great," I said. "We're standing by for target coordinates." I never received a single operational recommendation or a single page of actionable intelligence from Dick Clark. Donald Rumsfeld, the new Secretary of Defense, and I were headed to meet President George W. Bush and the remainder of the National Security Team. As we entered the cabinet room, I was aware of the history that had unfolded here. Within these paneled walls, Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, FDR and JFK had made decisions about world peace and global conflict. And I was stunned by the friendliness of the staff. I had never been invited to the Clinton White House, but colleagues had described a palpable coolness toward military officers. If the reports were accurate, this would be a very different White House. President George W. Bush looked younger than I had expected. There was a bounce in his step as he came around the table and shook hands with each of us. "We've got to get a picture of this, General," he said with a smile. "How often do two boys from Midland, Texas make it this far?" "Mr. President," I said, "there were days when I thought I'd never make it to second lieutenant." As we sat down, we were joined by Vice President Cheney, National Security Advisor Dr. Condoleezza Rice, and Andrew Card, the President's Chief of Staff. After Secretary Rumsfeld made some introductory remarks, each commander proceeded to describe his responsibilities. As I gave my 10-minute brief on Central Command and our area of responsibility, the cabinet room was absolutely silent. The President was focused, he listened intently, and he asked about troop levels and the leadership personalities in the region. Later that evening, our wives joined us for a reception and dinner in the White House's Blue Room. As Kathy and I chatted with old friends and spoke with Condi Rice and Vice President Cheney, President Bush walked up and said, 4 stars. "Wow, Midland boy has done well." I grinned, looked around the room, and said, "Mr. President, 2 boys from Midland seem to have done well." When we were about to be seated for dinner, President Bush tapped a glass and said, "Bow with me, please." As he said grace, I was struck by both the eloquence and the simplicity of the prayer, and I was reminded of the Pledge of Allegiance, one nation, under God. There was a certain comfort in hearing the President of the United States pray to a Heavenly Father. I was pleased on that night to have a man of faith in the White House. and over the critical years of American history that followed, my opinion never changed. On March 7, 2001, I had my first extended discussion with Donald Rumsfeld in the conference room of his Pentagon office. The SecDef managed to stay seated for several hours, although he did stroll over to the coffee bar on a few occasions to refill his cup with decaf. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld's tall, imposing intellectual alter ego, Special Assistant Steve Cambone, also attended the session. "I'm going over to the House Armed Services Committee again tomorrow, Mr. Secretary," I told him. "I've been in the job 8 months, and this will be my 8th hearing." Rumsfeld winced and turned to Cambone. "Steve, keep a log of congressional testimony senior DOD civilians and the military are called on to give." Then he turned back to me. "How was your last trip to the region, General?" During my career, I'd known a number of senior civilians in the Defense Department. Many of them had tried to out-acronym the people in uniform, but this man was different. I think I might have heard him use the term AOR twice, but he always seemed more comfortable with civilian vernacular. This didn't mean that he was not focused on his military responsibilities. Quite the contrary. I'd come to learn that he viewed his role as that of an advocate for, and a challenger of, the armed forces. Don Rumsfeld was no mere like-thinking affiliate, as several secretaries have been described, but rather a leader who wanted to use his own ideas to bring about change. At this early time in his tenure, he was already beginning to discuss transformation, changing the military to meet the needs of the 21st century. "This guy intends to change things," I thought, as we continued to speak. I was certain that the days ahead would mark the beginning of any number of studies that would make the service chiefs cringe. How to split the resource pie, how to adjust the end strengths of their branches, how to make America's armed forces more joint, and the list went on. Good for him. Some secretaries of defense saw themselves as 5-star generals positioned slightly above a constellation of 4-star flag officers. Rumsfeld wasn't so much elevated above us as he was in an orbit all his own. Generals and admirals learned to think in vertical and horizontal patterns. Rumsfeld's mind worked on the oblique, cross-cutting the traditional. I'd heard the rumblings of discontent from a few colleagues who accused him of being out in left field when it came to the practicalities of national defense. Maybe so, but my earliest sessions with him convinced me that he would be good for the military. Popularity is never as important as respect. In response to Rumsfeld's question, I described my most recent meetings in Bahrain, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. The secretary asked about the reaction I'd encountered in those countries to our recent attacks on several targets in Iraq. These strikes had included a rather vigorous response option, launched in the wake of a series of SA-2 missile launches at our planes. I carefully explained the response option procedure, avoiding the use of that acronym, RO, and said that our Arab allies had been ambivalent about the results, but generally appreciated the fact that we would use force when we thought it necessary. "How are the Saudis?" Rumsfeld asked. "The Saudis are difficult," I said. "On one hand, they want a close relationship with us. On the other, the royals don't want to create problems for themselves with their subjects, who would like to see us leave." Then I devoted 10 minutes to a careful description of Iraq's escalating reaction to our air patrols in both Operation Southern Watch and Operation Northern Watch, and told the secretary that we needed to modify our approach, either the number of patrols or the air tracks they fly, in order to reduce the risk to our air crews. Rumsfeld was quiet for a minute, then looked directly at me with his dispassionate blue gaze. "It seems to me we're just boring holes in the sky, General," he continued. "We need concrete goals. The current policy is open-ended. I want to recommend goals, objectives, approaches that make sense. Think out of the box. I don't care how we've always done it. Containment has not changed the regime's behavior. We still see Saddam shooting at our air crews. You have a lot of work to do, General." And then Rumsfeld smiled. I was about to reply when he continued, shifting focus as he spoke. "The sanctions against Iraq are collapsing," he said flatly. The Arabs make vague promises to help, but they deliver nothing. The Gulf War coalition is down to the British and us, and that can't last forever. He was being open, and so would I. The Israeli-Palestine situation affects everything out there, sir. The Intifada is all over media in the region every day, and until we solve that issue, the Arabs are not going to take risk to help us solve the Saddam problem. The discussion continued for 2 more hours, free-ranging and unpredictable. The summer of 2001 found our intelligence people working with the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency collecting and analyzing persistent but unspecific indications of planned terrorist activity in the Middle East. This was all source information, a blend of human intelligence and technical intelligence. I ordered the component commanders to have their people keep a lower profile. On several occasions, I increased our force protection posture, the threat con or threat condition, but never as a result of a specific threat. Something was brewing, but the best minds at the CIA and the National Security Agency couldn't pin down the threats with any degree of certainty. Where would we see the next terrorist act? And when? As I read the increasingly alarming reports of potential attacks on Western facilities in the region, a thought formed. Al-Qaeda had used cars, trucks, and boats as suicide bombs. What about small planes loaded with high explosives, I thought. I sent a note first to our embassy in Riyadh and then to other embassies across the area of responsibility, asking the ambassadors to pass on my concern to their host nations. We should work to tune in the host nations in the region to this type of threat, I said. In the first week of September, I worked with George Tenet and Assistant Secretary of State Christina Rocha to arrange a meeting with General Mahmoud Ahmed, the head of Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, the ISID, during a scheduled visit to Washington. I was eager to look deeper into the links between Pakistan and the Taliban and to assess the possibility that Pakistan might help us get to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda by increasing cooperation with our agencies. The meeting was set for September 10, 2001. On Friday, September 7th, I spoke to the CENTCOM intelligence staff in the MacDill Base Theater about the roles and responsibilities of the command as I envisioned them. At the end of the presentation, a young sergeant raised her hand and asked, "General, what keeps you awake at night?" A hell of a question. I thought a minute, then answered, "A terrorist attack against the World Trade Center in New York. That's what keeps me awake at night." The men and women in the audience listened intently. "If international terrorists were to strike a major blow against America," I added, "I fear the specter of the nation's military operating as combatants within our own borders for the first time since the 1860s. I spoke about the excesses of Reconstruction after the Civil War, which had resulted in the enactment of Posse Comitatus, the law that prevents military forces from serving as policemen inside the United States. Would that stricture survive a full-blown terrorist attack? "So the thing that keeps me awake at night, Sergeant," I'd emphasized, "is the possible use of our armed forces against American citizens. We do our job well, but we're trained to fight foreign enemies. We're not police officers, sheriffs, or the FBI. If we were ever required to act in that capacity during a major emergency like an attack on the World Trade Center, the effect on America could be devastating. Martial law would not sit well in a free and open society." Ceuta Bay, Crete, September 11, 2001. Just after 4 p.m., there was a pounding on my hotel door. "General Franks." It was Van Monney, my executive officer, or XO. I opened the door. "Sir," he said, his face pale, "you better check the TV. An airplane just crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center in New York." I pulled on my clothes as Kathy found the remote and turned on the television. "Osama bin Laden," I said, striding out the door. "I'm going to the comm room." Our communications center down the hall had several civilian phone lines and a large television tuned to CNN International. The room was filled with my staff. We watched silently as the channel flashed videotape replays of the burning skyscraper. The commentary was understandably chaotic and often contradictory. It was difficult to distinguish live images from tape, but then the widescreen snapped into a telephoto shot of a second jet slamming into the southern tower. As I watched the flames and roiling black smoke, a colorful graphic appeared on the bottom of the screen. America under attack. Osama bin Laden, I said. Son of a bitch. My fists clenched, but then the habits of a combat soldier returned. I was filled with cold rage, but externally calm. Now I understood the reason for General Massoud's assassination on September 9th. Having anticipated American retaliation in Afghanistan, bin Laden had taken preemptive action to cripple the Northern Alliance by killing their leader. Slowly I accepted this new reality. This terrorist, who had already killed hundreds of American diplomats, service members, and innocent foreign civilians, had just executed his most successful attack against my country, right on American soil. An unexpected insight flashed across my mind. Bin Laden is no coward. He's a deadly adversary, a worthy, bold commander of dedicated and capable forces, I thought. The phone line to CENTCOM headquarters in Tampa rang. It was General Michael Rifle DeLong. We could talk on this non-secure line while my communications people scrambled to set up an encrypted link. He gave me a sit-rep on the attacks and our immediate response. This much I knew already. America would respond militarily. That response would be aimed at Al-Qaeda, and it would be launched in Afghanistan. CENTCOM's commander and senior officers would have no time to grieve. This was not just another terrorist outrage. These attacks were an obvious act of war, and the first battles of that war would be fought in my area of responsibility. I had no doubt we were going to war, and it would be a war like none ever fought. There would be a national decision to put troops on the ground, and America now deployed military technology that hadn't even been imagined when I'd been with the 1st Cavalry Division troops during Desert Storm just a decade before. Sitting on the runway in my command plane in Crete, waiting for air clearance to fly into the U.S., I reflected on that talk I'd given to the CENTCOM intelligence staff just the previous Friday. America was in deep shock, reeling from the images of airliners smashing into buildings and those proud towers collapsing like flaming tinsel. Would my fellow citizens now be persuaded to abandon their hard-won individual freedoms to earn a bit more security in a clearly insecure world? Another thought struck me. Today is like Pearl Harbor. The world was one way before today, and will never be that way again. We stand at a crease in history. For the CENTCOM staff and me, the 10 days and nights between Tuesday, September 11th and Friday, September 21st were a time of intense focus and fatigue and caffeine overload. Some days seemed never to end. Some nights passed in a fast-forward blur. In a way, this was like combat, but without the noise, the sense of imminent danger, or that strange after-contact elation. And we were planning the first operation of America's next war, a war on terrorism that would begin in Afghanistan. Commanders and scholars have always spoken of the art of waging war, yet any war involves confronting certain basic hard, cold facts. That's the science of war. Gaining the fullest possible understanding of the enemy's strengths, capabilities, and intentions, giving adequate consideration to the terrain on which combat will take place, evaluating transportation requirements and the support of forces in adequate numbers, in this case halfway around the world. Choosing the correct mix of units to fulfill the mission, the aspect of military planning known as correlation of forces, which entails comparing friendly and enemy weapons and capabilities. All these elements lend themselves to modeling, to the strict judgments of empirical analysis. And all this science would have to be explained to Don Rumsfeld, the National Security Team, and ultimately to George W. Bush. And then we would discuss the art of war, the value of maneuver speed, mass of force, economy of effort, risk, timing, end state, and exit strategy. The plan I would present would include both art and science. We would not repeat the mistakes of the Soviets. We would destroy the Al-Qaeda network in Afghanistan, and we would remove the Taliban from power. As my dad would have said, lots of work to do, and not long to do it. For years I'd studied the strategy and tactics of past wars. As my staff and I reviewed our options in September 2001, I could not think of a historical parallel for the military campaign under consideration. The operation represented a revolution in warfighting. We would introduce the most advanced military technology in the world, Tomahawk cruise missiles, joint direct attack munitions, nicknamed bunker busters, stealth bombers, laser target designators, satellite communications, all of this onto one of the world's most primitive battlefields. The Northern Alliance, with its tribal affiliates, a few broken-down Russian tanks and rickety transportation helicopters, and thousands of horses, would move heavy weapons and munitions on the backs of donkeys and camels in a synchronized ballet, taking advantage of all that firepower and techno sophistication. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces had twice as many troops as the Northern Alliance. They were far better equipped. But I was confident that the balance of power was about to change. In the afternoon of September 21st, I joined Hugh Shelton, Dick Myers, and Major General Del Daley, the commander of Joint Special Operations Command, for the drive to the White House. Secretary Rumsfeld followed us a few minutes later in a Lincoln Navigator. President Bush received us in a comfortable study in the second-floor living quarters. Vice President Dick Cheney arrived as we did. I noticed at once that neither Secretary of State Colin Powell nor National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice was present. Rumsfeld had stressed the need for secrecy, and the group in this parlor was the smallest compartment possible. It was a hot day, and the President noted that we looked warm in our Class A uniforms. "Maybe these folks would like a Coke," the President said to a White House waiter. He brought a tray with ice, several bottles of Diet Coke, and crystal glasses with a presidential seal, and then left, closing the door. The President appeared relaxed and thoughtful as he poured each of us a Coke. "Tommy," he said, lighting a cigar. "Come over here and sit," he said, pointing to a chair beside him. "Well, Don," the President said to Rumsfeld, "what's Tommy got for us today?" "The General has prepared an operational concept for Afghanistan, Mr. President." The Secretary looked at me and nodded. "Go ahead, General." I distributed the briefing charts. "Mr. President, the operation will be executed in four phases," I began. "Phase one is already underway." President Bush was reading ahead. Almost immediately, he began asking questions. "How's progress on securing host nation support? We getting the bases we need?" I explained that President Musharraf of Pakistan had approved virtually every one of our requests concerning overflight, basing, and staging. "That's good," the President said. I added that Sultan Qaboos of Oman had granted permission for us to stage AC-130 gunships, Spectres, and Special Operations Forces, SOF, on Masira Island, and I was about to explain the importance of that location when the President spoke. "That puts how much of Afghanistan within the range of our aircraft?" he asked. President Bush, I knew, had flown fighters himself. He understood the strengths and limitations of air power. "We'll have plenty of operational range, Mr. President," I said. "Plus, we'll establish aerial refueling tracks inside Afghanistan once the fight begins." As I moved from page to page in the briefing, the President read closely, puffing his cigar in concentration. On virtually every page, he asked a pertinent question. The briefing had been scheduled for 2 hours, a significant block of time considering the President's commitments during this period of crisis. I realized we were going to run long, but felt I had to answer his questions as completely as I could. After about the sixth exchange, Don Rumsfeld pointedly checked his watch. "You'll have to move on, General." The President glanced up from a page showing Taliban early warning radar locations. "We're okay, Don. This is important information." "Go ahead, General. Just move along as quickly as you can," Rumsfeld said. I moved from one briefing chart to the next. The President asked his questions, and Secretary Rumsfeld listened attentively, joining the conversation on a number of occasions to stress key points. Flipping back to the target sets, the President looked up. We're going into Afghanistan to destroy the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. This is not retaliation. We are at war against terrorism, not the Afghan people. In my 36-year military career, I'd seen examples of confident leadership, but this was one of the most direct and decisive statements of policy I'd ever heard. Next, Major General Del Daley presented a summary of the Special Mission Unit targets in Afghanistan. We had been focusing on a suspicious Soviet-era fertilizer plant near Mazar-i-Sharif. The factory was surrounded by guard posts, and there were checkpoints on the roads leading in and out. Persistent intelligence reports showed Al-Qaeda members traveling to and from the plant. If the terrorists were working on chemical or biological weapons, that was a logical sight. As Del Daley finished his briefing, Secretary Rumsfeld spoke. "Mr. President, this campaign is going to be unprecedented. A lot of traditional lines will be blurred. I recommend that operational control of the CIA be given to the Department of Defense." Rumsfeld and I had discussed this. It was essential that I, as the commander, have control over all the forces in theater, and I knew the Secretary wanted to give me that authority. It was obvious we'd need a single belly button to push when the shooting started. Vice President Dick Cheney answered Rumsfeld, "Before this operation begins, we'll review all the command relationships." That was good enough for me. "Anything else, Tommy?" the President asked. "I believe it is essential, Mr. President, that we begin the humanitarian assistance operation simultaneously with our ground operations. We will want the Afghan people to know that we're not attacking them, but that our war is with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban." The President smiled. "Now that's what I'd expect from a boy from Midland." We laughed. "Seriously," the President said, "that's exactly what we want to do." At the end of the briefing, the President stacked his charts and studied the campaign summary for a moment. "When can you execute this plan, Tommy?" "Well, Mr. President, we'll have all the air forces in position in 5 days. All of our combat search and rescue assets will not yet be staged, but we can plan around that by using Tomahawk cruise missiles and B-2 bombers up in the north. I'll need 48 hours advance warning before we initiate operations." "Okay," the President said. "But what's your ideal timing, Tommy?" Everyone in the room, including Don Rumsfeld, listened intently. I knew the political pressure the President was under to demonstrate American resolve through military action against Al-Qaeda. Ground Zero in New York and a big wedge of the Pentagon across the Potomac were in ruins, but he was willing to give me the time I needed. "Mr. President," I said, "in about 2 weeks we'll have the required support from the nations in the region. I believe that will give Colin Powell and the State Department the time necessary to finalize combat search and rescue and special operations staging in Uzbekistan." The President considered this. "I understand. 2 weeks." "Sir," I said, "we could begin the air operations sooner, but over the long haul that would not be the best plan. We want air and special operations to begin as near simultaneous as we can get them." "I understand," the President said. "A large air operation would make a statement." Again, he paused to think. "On the other hand, I'm willing to wait. When we do this, we'll do it right." CENTCOM Headquarters, October 7, 2001. Later, the Central Command staff would refer to the period between that Sunday evening in Tampa, when the operation in Afghanistan first began, and October 18th as the 10 days from hell. Throughout those early days, the slow pace of our operations was a source of constant frustration. Our problem did not stem from a single easily resolved source. There were predicaments inside dilemmas. As a result, we were unable to insert Colonel John Mulholland's Special Forces teams into northern Afghanistan as quickly as either the Secretary or I wanted, an understatement of historical proportions. Rumsfeld's chronic impatience had never been so obvious. At this point in the operation, I had 2 scheduled phone calls a day with the Secretary, one at 07:45 hours in the morning and a second one at 16:30 hours in the afternoon. And there were many unscheduled discussions, some long, some short, to the point, and what you might call blunt. For 10 days, the first words the Secretary spoke in virtually every conversation concerned the Special Forces. "When is something going to happen, General? I do not see any movement, General Franks. What is the situation with those teams, General? The variations were few and subtle. Can you predict when something is going to happen, General? Where are those teams, General? Rumsfeld was never personally abusive, but he was not what you would call user-friendly. His questions continued, relentlessly. The answer was that we were all working on it, but moving the Special Forces teams with their vital combat air controllers out of Karshi-Khanabad on the Uzbek plains, across the valley of the Amudarya River, the Oxus of Alexander the Great, and into the Afghan highlands to link up with the Northern Alliance, proved a formidable challenge. The tactical situation in the north was complex. Taliban forces, supported by groups of Al-Qaeda troops, occupied the major towns and cities near the borders of Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, and they controlled the roads with a couple hundred former Soviet tanks and armored personnel carriers and dozens of ZSU-23 force, a particularly nasty tracked anti-aircraft weapon that was also a powerful anti-infantry tool. The Northern Alliance's best defended enclave was in Afghanistan's far northeastern corner, the former bastion of General Ahmad Shah Massoud, now commanded by Mohammad Fahim Khan. Abdul Rashid Dostam, an ethnic Uzbek, commanded the next strongest Northern Alliance formation. His forces and those of his erstwhile rival and sometimes ally, Mohammad Atta, held a string of strategic ridges and valleys south of the crossroads town of Mazar-i-Sharif. None of these warlords was a choir boy when it came to human rights, but they were saints compared to the Taliban, and they had experienced troops. They hated the Taliban and the Ariban, their derisive term for Al-Qaeda, which included large numbers of Chechens and Pakistanis, and they were more than eager to work with us. Our plan hinged on combining these tough, highly motivated opposition fighters with the coalition's massive air power. To do so, however, we had to have a Special Forces team, Operational Detachments Alpha, as they were known, or ODAs, with each of the local Northern Alliance commanders. And that was where we were stuck. An advanced Central Intelligence Agency team, codenamed Jawbreaker, was with Fahim, but other agency officers had yet to link up with Dostam, Atta, and their subordinates. Although we were establishing communications with the disparate Northern Alliance leaders, we'd yet to place any agency officers physically with them to pave the way for our Special Forces troops. John Mulholland's Task Force Dagger was growing, ready to move. We needed links with the Northern Alliance and transportation to insert the teams. The CIA had access to a few semi-airworthy Mi-17 helicopters, which they were using to support the Northern Alliance, and because the Taliban used similar helicopters, these aircraft were less likely to draw ground fire than the MH-60 Pave Hawks and MH-47s of the 160th Special Operations Group. I'd wanted Mulholland's Green Berets to be inserted on those Mi-17s, but the arrangement was not working. As Mulholland reported, the old choppers never showed up on schedule, and when they finally did arrive, they usually limped in with hydraulic trouble or some kind of engine problem that kept them grounded. And then there was the terrible weather. Our first attempted team insertions, one each to Northern Alliance allies Fahim and Dostam, were turned back by zero visibility dust storms. Subsequent flights encountered rain that turned into blinding snow as the old helicopters tried to crest the high passes. Soon it was obvious that the old Soviet equipment would not be reliable enough to meet our required timelines. But the designated airbase was not yet ready to support the helicopters of the 160th Special Ops Group that were standing by to be airlifted in from Germany. Mulholland and his Green Berets, assisted by hard-working Air Force base operations crews, were struggling to transform the area into a forward operating base. But as each day passed, the probability of bad weather along the mountainous infiltration routes increased. And that wasn't the only challenge. The agency advance officers faced the same or worse conditions operating out of Dushanbe, Tajikistan. After initial contact with Northern Alliance commanders, the CIA teams were often unable to return for days. And struggling to master their new satellite phones, The Alliance leaders went through batteries more quickly than they could be resupplied, so we would frequently lose contact with them for prolonged periods. Finally, 6 days into the operation, on a conference call linking me with John Mulholland, Gary Harrell, my director of security, and Bert Calland, the commander of my special operations forces, the report we'd been waiting for came in. Task Force Dagger would have MH-60 Pavehawks and MI-47s up and flying within 24 hours. That's great news, I told the team. But on the next day, John Mulholland reported that bad weather had struck again, almost causing the first coalition casualties of the campaign. An MH-60 carrying a team en route to Dostum had had its rotors ice up in a freezing mist above 12,000 feet. The aircraft had mushed in, landing hard, had been destroyed, and abandoned. The Green Berets and the crew had slogged down through the snow to a lower altitude, where they were picked up by a combat search and rescue chopper. And another Pavehawk had been hit by ground fire straining up a steep valley toward a pass. It had limped back to Karshikanabad. "We'll stay with it, sir," Mulholland reported, "but it's tough going out here." That seventh day into the operation, I answered another barrage of questions from Donald Rumsfeld. "What's the status of the team, General?" he began. I explained the difficulties, but made the mistake of slipping into aviation terminology, cluttering my report with terms like altitude density, which affected lift capability in mountain helicopter operations. "Do we have the right equipment out there or not, General?" Rumsfeld demanded. "We do, Mr. Secretary, but this is going to take a while." Rumsfeld was not pleased. The coalition had been bombing Afghanistan for over a week. International journalists who had swarmed in from Pakistan were transmitting video of American planes dropping bombs on mountainsides. Networks were running and rerunning tape of Taliban armored vehicles moving in daylight with apparent impunity. The BBC had broadcast a long, pessimistic report on the Northern Alliance being penned up behind their trench lines. Rumsfeld wanted results. He wanted to report tangible achievements, something beyond the airdrops of humanitarian daily rations. And even the humanitarian flights from Ramstein, Germany, were beginning to cause problems. Oxfam International got wide media play by reporting that hungry villagers in the bleak northern mountains were chasing the bright yellow plastic ration packs into minefields. Although there was no evidence that this had actually happened, the perception tainted a remarkable humanitarian effort. And there was more bad news. Since August, the Taliban had been detaining 8 Western volunteer workers from the German organization Shelter Now. Now the Taliban was threatening to try them for espionage and deliver their harsh brand of Islamic justice. Del Daly's special mission operators aboard the Kitty Hawk were planning a rescue operation together with agency field officers, but the media was spinning the drama to imply that the United States was powerless to help these innocent pawns. I was concerned, but in the video conferences I had with the White House, I noticed no anxiety from President George Bush as I described our difficulties in infiltrating the special forces. "Stick to the plan, Tommy," the president said. "We will be patient. This will take as long as it takes." The 10 days from hell ended on Friday, October 19th. Near midnight Afghan time, early afternoon in Tampa, John Mulholland inserted his 1st Special Forces A-Team into General Dostum's mud brick village headquarters south of Mazar-e Sharif. The MH-47 helicopters of the 160th Special Ops Group that had been trying for several nights to lift that team in, Operations Detachment Alpha 595, had finally been successful. We now had a 12-man, highly skilled Green Beret team, call sign Tiger 02, with Dostum's militia. Good weather was forecast in the coming 72 hours, and Mulholland reported that 2 more A-teams would soon be inserted, one to Mohammed Fahim, the other to Mohammed Atta. As more CIA elements linked up with other warlords, additional A-teams would be inserted with other Northern Alliance units. As soon as I heard from Mulholland, I called Dick Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon. "Tell the secretary we've got Special Forces troopers on the ground, and more are on the way." After meeting with Crown Prince Abdullah and other senior members of the royal family in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, I flew to Muscat, Oman, to reconnect with Sultan Qaboos. Your Majesty, I told the Sultan, Crown Prince Abdullah supports our operations against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And as you know, General Wald, who commands our air component, is based in the kingdom. Sultan Qaboos nodded. I recently visited His Royal Highness and raised the issue of continuing the war through Ramadan, I told the Sultan. And what was his opinion, General? Sultan Qaboos asked. Joining me in the meeting was Britain's Prince Andrew, the Duke of York, wearing his Royal Navy uniform. Prince Andrew was visiting Oman to observe British forces on a previously scheduled training exercise. And like the Sultan, he listened intently. His nation was our firmest ally in this war. If the sensitivities of the Muslim world forced us to pause for a lunar month when Ramadan began on November 17th, we risked a potentially crippling loss of momentum. By late December, the mountains of Afghanistan would be impassable with snow. On the other hand, we needed the support of Muslim nations like Saudi Arabia and Oman, and for many of their citizens, Ramadan was sacred. President Bush and Secretary Rumsfeld had instructed me to sound out my contacts on this crucial point. These leaders hope we can defeat the Taliban and Al-Qaeda before the start of Ramadan, I shook my head. But they understand that this may not be possible. Now I ask your opinion, sir. General, the Sultan said, permit me a question. People are asking if the United States will finish the job this time. He was referring to the token strikes we had launched against the Iraqi regime and Osama bin Laden in 1998. Your Majesty, America is a different country since 9/11. I'm a different man. We will finish the job this time. Sultan Qaboos was pleased. Good. As for the holy month of Ramadan, I don't think it will make any difference, General. Muslims sometimes go to war during Ramadan. He stood and shook my hand. You must continue the battle, General Franks. This Ramadan is for war. Flying across Afghanistan toward Tajikistan, I had an unusual conversation with Donald Rumsfeld. The Secretary, too, was airborne, headed for Tashkent, for more negotiations with President Karimov of Uzbekistan. Are you sure those special forces teams have senior enough officers in command? He asked. It seems to me the Northern Alliance generals won't really listen to those young captains and majors. Mr. Secretary, in a few weeks those warlords will think of those captains and majors as their sons. Our youngsters are very good at what they do. You're the commander, Don Rumsfeld said, but keep an eye on it. Months later, Assistant Secretary of Defense Tory Clark told me, you know, you and Don Rumsfeld complement each other. You make him a better secretary, and he makes you a better general. I think she was right. For me, the course of the war in Afghanistan in the first weeks of November 2001 unfolded in a blur of long video-lit days and nights, decisions made and objectives realized. I will leave the job of recapturing every detail to the military historians. What was important to me was that those fights were producing victories, and the victories were historic. Good to his word, Mohammed Fahim Khan delivered the vital towns of the north. Talakan, Kunduz, and Herat fell in rapid succession, all within a week. Tiger 02, the special forces team supporting General Abdul Rashid Dostum, led by a young captain, a seasoned master sergeant, and a lanky sergeant first class, whose noms de guerre were Mark, Paul, and Mike, fought one of the most tactically skillful and courageous small unit actions in American military history. Facing determined enemy resistance, terrible weather, and mounting casualties among their indigenous troops, these Green Berets used maneuver and air power to destroy an army the Soviets had failed to dislodge with more than 500,000 men. Dostum's forces routed the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and captured Mazar-i-Sharif on the afternoon of November 9, 2001. The Taliban and their airbound auxiliaries were defeated in the north. Other Tiger teams operating in the south used coalition air power to pound the enemy into submission. Hamid Karzai, who could affect the persona of a well-manicured scholar, was up to his chin in fierce combat north of Kandahar. When his forces were almost overrun by 500 Taliban advancing up a steep valley in a convoy of pickup trucks, Karzai trusted his American Special Forces advisors, led by a brave young soldier named Captain Jason Amerine, and he held his ground. Ammerine's team called in repeated airstrikes, some impacting within 200 meters of Karzai's fighting positions near the provincial capital of Terrencote. That engagement destroyed the last of the Taliban's operational reserves. The fall of Kandahar followed quickly. On the morning of November 27, 2001, I received an unexpected call from Secretary Rumsfeld. At the time, I was working with my Chief of Operations, General Gene Renwart, and his staff on air support for Afghan units pushing into the Spin Mountains around Tora Bora. "General Franks, the President wants us to look at options for Iraq," said Don Rumsfeld. "What's the status of your planning?" Throughout the operation in Afghanistan, the situation in Iraq had remained an issue. It was always within my peripheral vision. The pattern of attacks on our aircraft patrolling the no-fly zones had triggered response options at varying levels. It was a low-grade war, but a war just the same. Every morning as I jotted my daily notes on a fresh index card, I would think about aircrew shoot down in Iraq as a likely challenge. "Mr. Secretary," I said, "we have a plan, of course. It's called Operations Plan 1003. What's your opinion of it, General?" "Well, it's like Desert Storm 2. It's out of date. It's under revision because conditions have changed, Mr. Secretary. We have different force levels in the region than we had when the plan was written, and we obviously have learned some valuable lessons about precision weapons and special operations from our experience in Afghanistan." "Okay, Tom," Rumsfeld said. "Please dust it off and get back to me next week." Son of a bitch, I thought. No rest for the weary. I knew there was still hard fighting ahead in Afghanistan, but the main resistance had been shattered. The remnants of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were hiding in the snowy mountains of the southeast, subjected to relentless bombing, and 25 million Afghans had been liberated, all in less than 3 months of military operations. Life in Afghanistan was returning to normal, moving slowly and painfully but steadily toward the future, and away from the medieval darkness of the past. We had launched Operation Enduring Freedom, I reminded myself, on October 7th. Today, only 76 days later, most of the nation had been liberated. The remnants of the Taliban had retreated into the trackless high country north of Kandahar, or had joined Al-Qaeda survivors taking refuge in the mountains of the southeast. And Afghan troops under command of Hazrat Ali, supported by American, European, and Australian special operators, were closing in on the enemy in Tora Bora. We were pounding the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from the air, day and night, with laser-guided bomb units, the Bunker Busters, and with AC-130 Spectre gunships. We had solved the technical problems of establishing real-time video and data links between the Predator's flying reconnaissance and the AC-130s. What the CIA and Air Force Predator operators were watching on their plasma screens in the Langley parking lot and in the Combined Air Operations Center in Saudi Arabia, the targeting officers were also watching aboard the gunships patrolling north of Kandahar and above the Spin Mountains. When the unmanned aerial vehicles spotted the enemy, the AC-130s would arrive in a matter of minutes. Combat operations had gone remarkably well, but I knew this war was not over. Hazrat Ali reported that a large group of Arabs had taken refuge in a redoubt of caves and tunnels southwest of the Khyber Pass, and Ali's Afghan troops had encountered fierce resistance from heavily armed fighters dug into concentric defensive rings. Tora Bora would be a gunfight, and it would happen soon, before any Al-Qaeda leaders who might be holed up in there could escape. Before leaving CENTCOM headquarters, I discussed with my operations chief, Gene Renwart, and our ground component commander, Lieutenant General P.T. Miklachek, the coalition force structure we would use to stabilize the country. Secretary Rumsfeld and I had agreed that we would not flood the country with large formations of conventional troops. "We don't want to repeat the Soviets' mistakes," I told the secretary. "There's nothing to be gained by blundering across those mountains and gorges with armored battalions chasing a lightly armed enemy. This was the time to confirm our strategy. I plan to keep the force small. We'll tailor it to meet the mission. We'll not try to build a mission around the force." Our footprint had to be small, for both military and geopolitical reasons. I envisioned a total of about 10,000 American soldiers, airmen, special operators, and helicopter assault crews, along with robust in-country close air support. The three brigades from the 10th Mountain and 101st Airborne Divisions, as well as the Marine Expeditionary Units now at Camp Rhino and Kandahar, seemed about right. Miklachek had the task, and he was working it. On the afternoon of December 4, 2001, Gene Renwart and I met in the J3 Operations Conference Room at CENTCOM and presented the first iteration of my commander's concept to Rumsfeld and JCS Chairman Dick Myers in the Pentagon via secure video teleconference. Before the camera focus shifted to Rumsfeld and Dick Myers, I saw that JCS Vice Chairman General Pete Pace and Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Doug Feith were also attending the session. I certainly had no problem with Pete Pace sitting in. He was one of the brightest, most energetic officers I knew. But Doug Feith was another matter. No one could deny Feith's academic achievements. He had a magna cum laude bachelor's from Harvard and another magna from Georgetown Law School. But Feith was a theorist whose ideas were often impractical, and among some uniformed officers in the building, he had a reputation for confusing abstract memoranda with results in the field. My dealings with him had left me ambivalent. I liked him personally, but I wasn't convinced that the secretary was always well served by his advice. Doug was a master of the off-the-wall question that rarely had relevance to operational problems. It was obvious that Don Rumsfeld trusted him, and I wanted to use the products of his intellect, but I had little time or inclination to answer Doug's mind teasers. So I generally ignored his contributions and focused on what the secretary had to say. And Rumsfeld never allowed Doug Feith to interfere in my business. I was always thankful for that. I turned to the charts and expanded on the major points. "Mr. Secretary," I said, pointing to the first page, "assumptions. If we initiate military operations in Iraq, I'm assuming the principal objective will be to remove the regime of Saddam Hussein." I had not asked Don Rumsfeld's permission to propose this assumption. That's not how military strategists operate. My duty was to recommend the most effective and decisive employment of our armed forces in solving a particular problem. The civilian leadership, the Secretary of Defense and the President of the United States, would determine whether my strategic assumptions were appropriate. I waited a minute, watching Rumsfeld consider my words. "General," he said after a pause, "that is my assumption, too. The President will ultimately make that decision." "And, Mr. Secretary," I continued, "my second assumption is that if we conduct military operations, the objective will be to leave Iraq without the military capacity to threaten its neighbors with either conventional forces or weapons of mass destruction." Rumsfeld nodded. "I agree. If, and I emphasize if, this operation occurs, we will leave Iraq a unified nation with the ability to defend itself." "Sir," I said, "you already know what I think of Operations Plan 1003, but it is the plan we have today. It details force structure, logistics, and all the other requirements for a major operation. It's too big, too slow, and out of date. But if Saddam Hussein miscalculates, as he's prone to do, and shoots down one of our aircraft, or launches missiles into Kuwait or Israel, or decides to attack the Kurds, we need to have some practical and immediate response prepared." Rumsfeld weighed this logic. "Cruise missiles and airstrikes." "It's what we have on the books right now, Mr. Secretary," I continued. "It's stale, conventional, and predictable. Worst of all, it's premised on continuing the policy of containment. My commander's concept has a different set of objectives." I flipped the page and pointed to end state, and to two red highlighted starbursts, regime change and WMD removal. Rumsfeld and Myers studied the page. Rumsfeld said, "Let's get back to the existing plan. After initial airstrikes, the ground force buildup takes an inordinate amount of time. We can do better, Mr. Secretary, but I wanted to show you what we have before proposing where we go." "Proceed, General," Rumsfeld said with a smile. Donald Rumsfeld usually liked his briefings swift and concise. This one moved more slowly. He obviously wanted to lay a solid foundation for whatever circumstances might develop in the coming months. The intelligence community had been speculating about a possible connection between Saddam's regime and known terrorists, including Al-Qaeda. The evidence was not airtight, but it was certain that several terrorist camps of the Ansar al-Islam group were up and running in northern Iraq. These camps were examples of the terrorist harbors that President Bush had vowed to crush. One known terrorist, a Jordanian-born Palestinian named Abu Musab Zarqawi, who had joined al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, where he specialized in developing chemical and biological weapons, was now confirmed to operate from one of the camps in Iraq. Badly wounded fighting coalition forces in Afghanistan, Zarqawi had received medical treatment in Baghdad before setting up with Ansar al-Islam. And evidence suggested that he had been joined there by other al-Qaeda leaders, who had been ushered through Baghdad and given safe passage into northern Iraq by Iraqi security forces. What was especially troubling about this intelligence were reports that Zarqawi and his al-Qaeda colleagues were using the camps to train other terrorists for WMD attacks in France, Britain, Chechnya, and the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. In January 2003, when British police broke up a terrorist cell in Manchester that Zarqawi had helped train, they discovered traces of ricin, the deadly biological toxin, in the terrorist's flat. Reports indicated that they were plotting to use it to poison the food supply on military bases across Britain. If the evidence were confirmed that the Iraqi regime was in fact linked to al-Qaeda, there would be an insatiable appetite in Washington for immediate